Hi, I'm Renelle, and I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen.
Hi,
everyone. And yes, Carlin, it was a moment of insanity when I accepted to chair the Al-Anon portion of the AA convention, but it was also very rewarding, and I'm glad I did it. And I had some wonderful people who are in this room tonight that supported me because I could not have done it on my own. And happy birthday, everybody. Wow, that is so exciting to have so many birthdays this month. What is it, August? It must be a big month for but I'm here to share with you tonight a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I will have to say to start off with, I don't really like to go back and think about what it used to be like. But I also know that if I don't do that, then I'm headed for a slip. I'm headed right back there. So it is important not only that I remember that so that I don't go back there, but also it keeps me in touch when that newcomer walks in the door and they're hurting because I can identify with them. I was born in 1952 in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a native Atlantan, and I'm proud of it. And if y'all can't tell by my accent, I don't know. But I was born in what I would consider a middle-class family. My father worked for the Atlanta Fire Department, and my mother worked for Ivan Allen Company. And I don't know how many of y'all are familiar with that, but Ivan Allen Jr. ended up being the mayor for the city of Atlanta at one point. No, that was Ivan Allen Sr. She worked for Ivan Allen Jr. But anyway, so both of my parents worked, and so I was what you would call a latchkey child. But I did have, up until I was in about the third grade, we did have a maid that come in, and she would clean the house and watch me after school. I also had an older brother, and I can tell you that growing up, the story was that when I was born and I was brought home from the hospital, my brother asked him, is it a boy or a girl? And they said it was a girl. And he said, take her back. I want a brother. And while that was a funny story and everybody liked it, it always made me feel like I was not quite enough, that I was not accepted. And my brother was 5 years older than I was, and he picked on me all the time. We were not loving brothers and sisters. We fought. And neither of my parents drank. And I was not exposed to alcohol, had not been around alcohol until I was about 12 years of age. However, my mother was brought up by an alcoholic father. She had a sister that died of alcoholism. Her sister was in and out of AA for several years, but I was never exposed to that. She lived in Miami, and I never saw her drunk. But I always remember Mother talking about, especially to my brothers, when he started going out and driving and things like that, because he would have a tendency to drink. And I remember her always saying, do not drink alcohol because alcoholism runs in the family. Well, that's all I knew about alcoholism. You know, I didn't know what it looked like or anything like that. I just knew that it was something that ran in our family and we weren't supposed to do it. So when I was 12 years old, there was a family that moved in across the street from us, and they had five children. And they had a little girl that was a year younger than me, and they had two boys older and another one two smaller. And there was always something going on over there. You know, if there's a lot of kids around, there always seems to be a lot of excitement. And I liked that excitement. And so I would play with them. But let me back up just a little bit. I want to tell you about the God of my understanding when I was a child. I went to Sunday school, and I learned about God there. And I learned, you know, that Jesus loves me, this I know. And I also learned that if you did good, God would reward you. And if you didn't, then he would punish you. We traveled. My dad wanted to see the United States. And so we traveled and went out west every summer. We went out Interstate 10 one year, out Interstate 20 another year, out Interstate 40 the next year. You know, so we saw the United States, and one of the things that we did a lot of is we went to national parks and we went to national monuments. And so what I learned by going to all these national parks was I learned the beauty of God through nature. And I knew that God was all-powerful. You know, when you look at the Grand Canyon, you look at the Grand Teton Mountains, and you go through Yellowstone National Park, you cannot have a doubt in your mind that something greater than anything on this earth created that. And so I knew that without a doubt in my mind that God was all-powerful. So I'm 12 years old, and this family moves in across the street, and they have all the kids, and I love being over there, and these parents drink. But I don't ever really notice or see them as drunk, but I do see them drinking, you know, the laughter would pick up and things like that. And I enjoyed being over there. Well, it was at this time that the father in this family stole my innocence. And when that happened, I got mad at God. And I said, if God loves the little children of the world, why would he have allowed this to happen to me? And so what I concluded was that God didn't love me. And I turned my back on God and I walked out. Because you see, if God was all-powerful, he had the power to have prevented that. So it wasn't that he didn't have the power to, that he didn't have the ability to, it was that he chose not to. I didn't tell anyone, and so this became my secret. And what I found out when I walked through the rooms of Al-Anon is that we're only as sick as our deepest secrets. So I became sick at the age of 12, because that's when I started making up the lies. Now, the thing that happened to me when I was 12 years old is I took on unearned guilt and I took on unearned shame. And I felt that I was damaged goods. And because there had been boundaries broken, by the time I was 16, I started dating. I didn't know how to date. And so at the tender age of 16, I became pregnant and had to quit school. Because back in those days, you didn't go to school pregnant. And I was given a choice by my parents. One was I had an uncle that lived in Portland, Oregon, and I could go to Oregon and I could live with him, give the child up for adoption, and then come back and finish school. My second option was to have an abortion, and abortions were illegal back then. And my third option was to get married, and I chose the third option. The reason I did that was because I knew I was damaged goods and nobody else would ever have me. That is not a good reason to get married. And I will have to say that that marriage was unsuccessful, and within 2 years I was divorced. And when I divorced, I wanted out of that relationship so badly that I was willing, although divorce papers required you to put in there that you would get child support, we made a verbal agreement that I would not get child support provided he would not see the child. And at this point, I'm 18 years old. I have a daughter to raise, and I've never even finished high school. And so I went and I got a GED, and so I came up with Plan B. And Plan B was I was going to find a man that had enough money that he could support me and my daughter. And that's what I was going to do. And so I did. And I can tell you that it was a very abusive relationship. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and that person ended up going to jail. And I got out of that relationship because I was so fearful to leave that relationship. I was afraid that he would kill me or my daughter one. So then I came up with Plan C. You know, a good Al-Anon, we always have plenty of plans. And so at Plan C, at this point, I reached the decision that I would never be dependent on another living soul as long as I lived. And I had gotten my GED, and I landed a job with a major corporation that allowed you to come in on the ground floor, and if you worked hard and did your due diligence, you could work your way up. I will say that after 28 years with that company, I had worked my way up into middle management. I was an overachiever in high school. I made the honor roll all the way through, and you know that paid off for me later since I did not finish school. So at this point, I'm about 20 years old, and I've got a job. I'm able to support myself. I'm able to support my daughter. And I'm just dating and having a good time, you know, but there's still this soul sickness in me, and I still want, you know, I wanted and needed to be loved. And so I'm out at the swimming pool at my brother's apartment, and all of a sudden, he comes walking across the side of the pool. And it was him. It was him. Y'all know what I mean. It was him. And he was built like a miniature Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he had blonde hair and blue eyes, and I was in love. And I, you know, I saw him walking across there, and I thought, you know, if he, I was floating on a raft out in the pool, and I thought, if he flips me over, I'm going to marry this man. Well, he flipped me over and brought me up in his arms, and my bathing suit top had come off. And so while he's enjoying the view, what he doesn't realize is he has just proposed matrimony to me. And I tell him, you just don't know what you've gotten yourself into. So anyway, we dated for 3 years before we made that commitment to get married. But I will say that when I married this man, I knew without a shadow of a doubt this was somebody I wanted to grow old with. And we really, during those dating years, we would go down to Underground Atlanta. And back in those days, you could go to Underground Atlanta, and I forget what night it was, but it was one night during the week. It was penny a beer and 25 cents mixed drink. I was a cheap date, you know. And we would go down there, and we would stay until the bars closed. And, you know, it was really interesting because I would try and drink as much as he could, but I never could quite get there. But we would go, and one night I wouldn't drink, and I would drive us home, and the next night, I didn't think he was drinking. He was, but, you know, maybe not quite as much, and he would drive us home. And so we did this, and we partied, and we had a good time, and then we decided to get married. Well, the one thing that we didn't do before we got married was we didn't talk about what we wanted our relationship to be. You know, so I had this picture that we would get married and the partying would quit and we'd settle down and we'd have the house with the little white picket fence. Well, we got married and we went to the courthouse and got married at the courthouse. And as soon as we left there, we went by the package store and got a 12-pack of beer. It was not his intention to quit partying. You know, and so at this point, you know, my daughter's getting old enough, she's ready to start school. And so I can't go out and party every night like he was. And so he would go out and he would drink and I would be home with the child and wanting him to come home and eat dinner, you know, so we could have dinner at a decent hour, go to bed, you know, so get up and go to work the next day. And that wasn't happening. And so slowly over a period of time, I began to change. And so this man that I loved and adored, I began to berate him. And I began to put him down and, you know, why can't you come home and why can't you do these things? And I would take my anger out on my daughter if he wasn't home because I expected her to be perfect. And, you know, what I found was that I was turning into a monster in order to fight this monster of a disease called alcoholism. But I didn't know I was married to an alcoholic. You see, an alcoholic to me looked like the wino that lived under a bridge. I did not know that an alcoholic could be functioning and hold a job and, just hold a job, how's that? Be married, you know, could have a home, could have a house, you know. But, you know, the reality is he wouldn't have that house had it, you know, the house was in my name. The mortgage was in my name. I was making the house payments. I was enabling him. I was getting resentful, and he was starting to dislike me. And so we rocked along in this disease, and it was it got worse. I can tell you that this was back before the days of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And by the time that he did walk through the doors of AA and get sober, we went back and we counted the number of DUIs that he had had. And when we got to 20, we quit counting. Every spring, every fall, or every spring, every Christmas, he was getting arrested for DUI and I was bailing him out of jail. And that's the way our life was. I hated to see the spring come and I hated to see Christmas come. So things got really bad, and I remember sitting at home. My daughter was fixing to graduate from high school, and she left, not because of him, but because of me. I was so hard on her. I demanded perfection from her, and she resented me. Her and the alcoholic, they got along fine, but she resented me. And so I was sitting there one night. He was out on a drunk. He would go out on binge drinking 3, 4, 5 nights at a time. I wouldn't see him. And she had run away from home. And I was sitting there, and I thought, you know, this is supposed to be the happiest time of her life, to get ready to graduate from high school and go on and spread her wings and begin to build her life. And here I sit, surrounded by 4 cold, lonely walls. I am all alone. And it was at that point that I hit my bottom. And I started looking. And I found, I finally found my ways through into the rooms of Al-Anon. And when I walked into that first meeting, now I'm going to tell you, when I went to that first meeting, I did not want to be here. I thought that I was better than you. That I really didn't know that I was married to an alcoholic. I still did not know I was married to an alcoholic, didn't believe I was married to an alcoholic. However, if you read the description of the different stages of alcoholism in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was in stage 4. But I walked through the doors of Al-Anon, and that very first meeting I knew I had come home. I felt more love, more understanding, and more compassion than I had ever known in my entire life. And I wanted what you people had. And so what I did is I reached out and I started coming to meetings. But, you know, this was in the day when, I don't know about your group, but I know my group, it's not quite like it used to be. But there was a lady in that room that night that she said, "Here's my phone number, and can I have your phone number? And I'll call you next week, and we'll ride to the meeting together." And she took me under her arm, and she started taking me through the motions. And, you know, when she asked for my phone number, I thought, oh, Lord, I don't want to give her my phone number. Because, you know, when you go to church and you go into a Sunday school class, they want your phone number, and then they call you and ask if you're coming to church the next week. I did not want that happening. You can't have things like that happening when you're living with an alcoolic. You know, it'll start an argument. It'll start World War II. And so anyway, but she called me and she said, "I'll be by to pick you up at 7:30. And at 7:30 on the dot, she pulled into my driveway. Now, that was important to me because, you see, the alcoholic had always told me, "I'll be home in an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours later, I might see him." For somebody to do what they said they were going to do and to do it was important to me. I knew this was somebody I could trust. I knew this was somebody, when they said what they meant what they said. And so we started going back and forth to meetings, and we would have the meeting before the meeting, we'd have the meeting after the meeting, and she would talk to me, and then she would say, "Well, why don't we meet for breakfast on Saturday?" And we would meet for breakfast on Saturday, and we would talk. And without my knowing it, she started sponsoring me. And then when I learned what sponsorship was about, I made it formal, and I asked her to be my sponsor. Now, what's important about asking somebody to be your sponsor is because you give them permission to take your inventory. They're the only person that has permission to take my inventory. And what's important about that is also is that it's like she told me, she said, "I will tell you the things that nobody else is willing to tell you, because I love you enough to be honest with you." And I needed that. You see, I was a people pleaser, and I would tell you the things that I wanted you to that you wanted to hear. And she was honest enough to tell me that I wasn't going to get away with that behavior anymore. She took me through the steps, and I will say at that point in time, it's when we had the blueprint for progress that had all the questions, and I answered, it was the little blueprint for progress, and I answered them yes, no, sometimes, maybe. And so she had me write out my story, and I did that. But I still, I had this hole deep down inside of me, and it couldn't be filled. And it had to do with what happened to me when I was 12 years old. And my sponsor had not experienced that, and she could not help me with that. But what she did do was she put me in touch with somebody that could. You see, that's the beauty in this program. We don't always have to know all the answers because there's always somebody else that has experienced it. And if you got a good sponsor, they'll put you in touch with that person to help you walk you through that experience. And so I did that, and I can tell you that hole was filled, and I've never had to bleed again. It was filled. I've never hurt that bad again. After I was in Al-Anon for about 9 months, the alcoholic walked through the doors of AA, and he got sober. And we began rebuilding our life. And, you know, that was tough also because there were a lot of things that I had taken responsibility for, such as the checkbook, and I wasn't really willing to give it up and share it. And he felt that he could be trusted and could have that responsibility. And so it took a lot of negotiating for us to do that. But we worked through those issues, and we worked through a lot of other issues. And the thing about it is that we started making living amends. And what you told me was that courtesy started at home, and I had to start being courteous at home. And I started having to tell him thank you and please. And I had to ask for when I needed help. And I started doing those things, and I could only do them because you held my hand through the process. You know, I would call my sponsor and say, this is what's going on. What do I do? And she says, well, have you talked to him about it? Well, no, and I don't intend on, you know. And she said, well, nothing's going to change until you can open up and get honest about it. And so I would, and we would go through that process. We were living the life of Al-Anon and AA. We were going to the conventions. We had sponsors. We were actually sponsored by a couple. And that was really great because we took a lot of trips together, went to a lot of conventions together, and became really, really close. And so fast forward, and it's 2004, and I'm working, and... let me back up a little bit. I had been laid off from work after 2001. I was laid off. I was given full retirement and a package to leave the company. And then they called me back a year later and wanted me to contract back. So I was contracting back with them. And the important thing of that is when that layoff came, there were a lot of people that were laid off. Al-Anon had taught me, don't burn bridges. You know, and I can tell you that when you're laid off, even though it's not due to your work, it's due to the economy, it hurts. And there were a lot of people that were hurt through that process, and a lot of people left angry and did a lot of destructive things. But you had taught me not to burn bridges, and I had actually trained the person who was going to replace me. So that by doing that, a year later, they called me back to contract for them. And so that was a miracle within itself. So I'm contracting back with them, and it's 2004. And I come home from work, and my husband's retired at the time. And normally, it was the day that the trash man comes. And normally, he was particular about as soon as the trash came and picked up, he would go out to the curb and bring the garbage cans back to the house. And he also was supposed to have a meeting that night. He was in a fishing club, and they were supposed to have a meeting. And when I came home, he was still there, and the trash cans were out by the street. Now, he had not been feeling good for a couple of weeks now. And I really thought that it was his heart, and it really scared me when I pulled into the driveway that night. I thought, I'm going to go upstairs, and I'm going to find him laid out on the floor. Well, I get upstairs, and he's fine. But he says he's sick and he's having double vision and these sort of things. And so I took his temperature. He didn't have a temperature. You know. And I said, I don't know what's wrong. I said, but I think we need to go to the emergency room. And he said, no, I'm not going to the emergency room. And I said, you either go to the emergency room or I'm calling an ambulance because you're scaring me. So bottom line, we went to the emergency room. He was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and it had metastasized and gone to the brain. And he was given 4 months to live without treatment, and with treatment, he was given 15 months average. And he decided that he wanted to buy as much time as he could. And what I learned at that point was I learned the difference between caretaking, which is what I had done in the early part of our marriage, and caregiving. And caregiving is when you allow someone to make their own decisions and you support them. And so for the next 9 months, I became his caregiver. And it was the most beautiful time in our relationship. Most difficult, most painful, most loving, most beautiful. I really had to put my program into action. And when he was diagnosed, he was at the hospital, and I came home, and I went into my bedroom, and I got down on my knees, and I did what you had taught me to do. I got down on my knees, and I said, God, I am powerless. I do not know how to handle this. I had never been exposed to anyone with cancer. I didn't know what it looked like. I knew it was not a good diagnosis. And I gave it to God and told him, you're going to have to help me. And so what he did, you cannot imagine the support that God put around us. First of all, the company that I was contracting back with, I called them to tell them what was going on and that I couldn't work anymore. And they said, Rennell, we want you to work for us. We will set you up an office in your home, and you can work from home. And when you're available, that's great. You keep up with your own time, turn in your hours. And I said, well, you don't understand. I said, if I'm in the middle of a conference call and he needs me, you must understand he is my first priority. And they said, that's fine. Just come, just let us do this for you. That was a wonderful thing, because as those 9 months went on and he went through the chemo and the radiation and everything, it gave me some place to focus my mind. It gave me some place to focus my mind. I needed that. God gave me that. Someone else told me, they said, Rennell, and this was key to the whole thing for me. They said, Rennell, don't be so focused on the big miracle, because you may not get it. Don't be so focused on that big miracle that you miss all the little miracles along the way. And I was able, one day at a time, to focus on the little miracles. My daughter, who and I had been so hard on growing up, we were estranged. She would not talk to me. And I had to call her and tell her what was going on. And she came. He had a son from a previous marriage, called him. He came. And once again, our family was united. And my kids were there, and they stood by both of us, and they helped us, and they walked through this with us. And his mom and dad were still alive, and they would come, and they would support us. And AA and Al-Anon came. When he was diagnosed with this, I called my sponsor, and my sponsor came over immediately, and she stayed with me for the next 3 days while we went through to get the prognosis and everything. When he had to go to in-house hospice because I could no longer care for him at home, I had caretaker breakdown, caregiver breakdown. And the hospice nurse came, and when she saw me immediately, she just picked up the phone and said, I need a room. I've got caregiver breakdown. And he went to in-house hospice, and they started taking care of him there. And my sponsor would come down every day, and she would sit with us. And one day we were out in the parking lot, and we're wheeling him around in the wheelchair. And she leaned over, and she said, who loves you, Dickie? Well, I just knew he was going to say me. You know, I just knew that was what he's going to say. But he didn't. He said, God loves me. Sweetest words I ever heard. Because you see, I knew that he was good with his maker. We were good with each other. We were good with the kids. We were good with our family. And he was good with his maker. And shortly after that, he did pass away. And the kids had come up to the house, and they were spending the night, and I couldn't sleep. 3 o'clock in the morning, I called my sponsor. I said, I need to talk. She said, come on over. I'll have the coffee ready when you get here. And I went over, and we had coffee, and we sat out. She had a prayer garden out in her backyard, and we sat out in that prayer garden. And I hurt so bad, I thought I was absolutely going to go insane. And it was at that moment that suddenly I just felt God's arms wrap around me. And I heard that small, still voice say, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Went through that process, and by the way, when they had turned him over to in-house, or when they had turned him over to hospice care, I had called my company once again and said, I can't work anymore. And they said, okay, we'll come pick up all the equipment. And they did. And after the funeral, a couple of months later, I got a call from my boss again, and she said, Renee, are you ready to come back to work? And I said, no. I said, I need at least 6 months. At least 6 months. 3 months after the death, she called. She says, Renee, are you ready to come back to work? I said, no, I really would like to take 6 months. And she said, we really would like to have you. I said, but you don't understand. I said, I can't focus. I would start to do something, and my mind would go somewhere else. And the type of work I did required you to focus. I wrote methods and procedures, and I had to talk with business analysts, and I had to talk with programmers a lot. And so it required a lot of detail work. And I said, I can't focus. And she said, I don't care. She said, we just want you back. And so I went back to work. And I have no idea how my work was, you know, but it was good to be back. And they, you know, oh, and the other thing was when I went back, I said, I only want to work 3 days a week. She said, that's fine. She said, what 3 days do you want to work? I was like, oh, I like this. How about Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday? And I, she said, okay. She said, okay. This program did that for me. You know, when we are open and honest and we do the right thing and we do the very best that we're able to do, it comes back to us. It comes back to us. And so it came back to me then. The other thing that happened is that there was a member of AA that I had known for over 20 years, and he had been separated from his wife for 13 years. And Dickie never liked for him to spend Christmas alone, and so he would invite him up to the house every Christmas and Thanksgiving, and he would spend that time with us and our family. And after Dickie died, he came up, and he would do my yard work for me, and I said, you've got to quit doing my yard work. You know, show me how to put gas in the lawnmower and stuff like that. I can do it. Show me how to do the weed eater and all that. And he never would show me. He would just come up and do it. And finally, one day, he had worked in the yard, and he asked me if I would like to go out for dinner, and I said, well, okay. And we got in his car, and he looked over at me, and he said, Renelle, he said, I'm really kind of uncomfortable. I don't know about this. He said, it kind of feels like a date. And I looked at him, and I said, well, I don't know how to do it either, because the last time I had a date, they didn't even have seatbelt laws. And I had never dated anybody where alcohol was not involved. I had never done that. Even in high school with my first husband, first party I went to with him, there was alcohol involved. So I had never dated anybody when alcohol was not involved. And so this was a new experience for me, and I've got to hurry up. Needless to say, we moved right along, and we got married. And we've been married for 9 years now, and it's been a wonderful 9 years. And he's entirely different from my first husband, but the beauty of it is we have a relationship in where we have no history with one another of this disease. And therefore, at least for me, I'm able to be much more open and honest. And, you know, when we first got together, it amazed me at how quickly I could speak up when things were unacceptable to me. I realized that I did not have that reluctance to speak up, but that I knew who I was. I knew the woman I had become. I knew that I was a child of God and that I was loved. And I knew that because I had been loved. I had been loved and I had been respected, and I had to gain that love and respect out of the disease of alcoholism. So here I was now in recovery with someone else, and I knew how to do it. I knew how to do it. And it's been good. And, of course, he has called me on some of my things, too. And I have to love and respect him for that also. And so we have a wonderful relationship today that's based on honesty. And it's based on trust. What I would have to say is that I love this program. It has saved my life. I love AA and I love Al-Anon and I love all the members in there. You know, each and every one of you means so much, whether I know you personally or not, just the fact that you're here. And it's important to me that Al-Anon be here in the future. And that's why I do the things like when Carlin calls and says, will you tell your story? Well, yeah, I'll tell my story. You know, because somebody did it for me. You know, I had to hear somebody else talk about what it used to be like and what happened and how it is today in order for me to get better. I came in here and you held my hand and you walked me through the walk. You talked me through the talk. You walked me through the walk. You showed me how to do it. You encouraged me. And I have to say that I could not do it without a loving God of my understanding. Today I have a loving God of my understanding and you gave me that. What I learned in these rooms was I learned that God loves me through other people. God loves me through you. And so today, there's a little prayer that I love to start my day off with. And it goes like this, if I can remember it. I put my arms on the windowsill of heaven, and I gaze up to my higher power. And with that vision in my heart, I turn, and with new strength, I face today. Thank you. Thank you.